Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Sunzone Session 322. I'm very encouraged to see so many people who are aware and probably fans of Karen Armstrong. I have been a reader of hers for about 12 or 15 years, and I was so excited that there would be a session devoted to her work and thought here. And we have a presenter and a respondent. Our presenter is Holly Walker. She won the New Eve Poetry Contest. Pardon me. New Era Poetry Contest in 1983. She has an essay entitled Satin Worship about her love of textiles. Forthcoming in Best American Essays 2005. She has served a mission in Taiwan in 85 and 86 and wrote a memoir about the experience, which her agent is still trying to place. Born and raised in southeast Arizona, she currently lives and writes in northwestern Pennsylvania. Please welcome Holly Walker.
Would somebody mind shutting the doors? I just am easily distracted. I really didn't expect such a large audience. I'm really, really gratified. And I hope that even though some of you are fans of Armstrong, that some of you are new to her work, since if you've read a lot of her stuff, this is kind of an overview and an introduction. You might not learn a whole lot that's new. A note on sources, first of all, although Karen Armstrong has published more than a dozen books, I cite only five in this presentation. They are, in order of publication, Through the Narrow Gate, Beginning the World, A History of God, The Battle for God, and The Spiral Staircase. And another note, as a literary scholar, I interspersed quotations throughout my text, and it will be redundant and silly if I say quote, close quote every time I have a quote. So I'll just try to like sound different when I and hopefully if there's something you want to know where it's from, I'll be happy to provide you with page numbers or citations or such. All right. Karen Armstrong has stated that she wrote Through the Narrow Gate, a memoir about the 7 years she spent as a Catholic nun in 1960s England, because she realized that one of the most significant periods of her life was being trivialized, reduced to a set of comic stories she could relate at dinner parties, much to the delight of her hostesses, who introduced their ex-nun to the other guests with as much glee and satisfaction as if they were pulling a rabbit out of a hat. Telling a few amusing anecdotes was easier than exposing memories that were still raw and painful, but Armstrong knew that at some point she would want to discover what those years had meant before the memories disappeared beyond recall. Armstrong begins Through the Narrow Gate with an account of her life in post-war England. Born in a suburb of Birmingham in 1944, she grew up with plumbing we would find appallingly primitive, but other than that, her childhood seems unexceptional. She had devoted parents, a younger sister who could not have been more different from her, and a good-natured, alcoholic grandmother. Her parents were dedicated but not zealous Catholics. They educated their two daughters at a private Catholic girls' school, but could not have been more horrified when their oldest daughter announced that she wanted to renounce travel, good food, normal human companionship, and even the possibility of marriage in order to become a nun. It seemed obvious to Armstrong, even as a young girl, that nothing could be as fulfilling as a life dedicated to God, and having realized that, there was no alternative but to make that dedication and become a nun. Swayed by the arguments of Mother Catherine, the headmistress at Armstrong School, Armstrong's parents reluctantly agreed to let her become a religious instead of going to university. In September 1962, shortly after completing school and shortly before turning 18, Armstrong entered the convent of an austere order to spend 9 months on probation as a postulant and see if she had the discipline and courage necessary to move on to the next step and become a novice, undergoing a second period of trial and training, this one lasting 2 years before she could take more enduring vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Her order was founded in the 1840s and its rules and customs were based on the conduct considered appropriate for Victorian women. The religious life in the order was originally intended to be an extension of their normal lives, not a complete divorce from everything they had known before. But, after 120 years, many of the anachronisms of life in the order had developed which had developed by a type of historical accident, had become endowed with a weighty religious significance. One of those anachronistic rules was that at every meal, members of the order were urged to make one real act of mortification. Excuse me, one act of real mortification, which might be achieved by taking an extra big helping of something you disliked, or, if you liked everything on the table, finding a way to spoil it for yourself, doing without salt, for example. Armstrong encounters an opportunity for mortification at her first meal when she finds the main course is macaroni and cheese. Armstrong clearly suffered from an intolerance or allergy to dairy products. Milk products in general had long made her ill, and she vomited whenever she ate cooked cheese. But this physical disorder is seen as mere weakness of will, and with one exception, her superiors instruct her to eat more, not less, cheese, as she obviously needs to train her system to get rid of this weakness as soon as possible. The goal of such mortifications, and indeed the entire training, is to force the religious to confront and discard the ego, the self, that part of us which says, I, since according to the order's ideology, it is only when there's no self left at all that God can fill us entirely with himself. To help with the process, novices were assigned pointless tasks, like scrubbing a recently washed stone staircase with a fingernail brush. If they demurred in any way against such a waste of time and effort, they were rebuked for their lack of complete and utter obedience. They were informed that every failure, a badly swept floor, a torn skirt, a bungled hem, is a religious fault, a sign that they were failing in the service of God. They were made to confess their faults publicly and, lest they overlook one, were routinely reminded of them, criticized and punished in ways that seem vicious and cruel. The system was so brutal, so focused on judgment, penalty, and penance, that only a sadist could enjoy enforcing it. Not surprisingly, the older nuns responsible for training the younger ones were often hardened and hurt by the requirement that they never tolerate weakness or frailty in their charges. One would have to be a remarkable person indeed not to be injured by a job whose specific duties and obligations included ruthlessly eradicating another person's sense of self. However, all that was simply part of the system, and analysis or criticism of the system by those living in it was out of the question. Of course, analysis and criticism were occurring elsewhere. Reformers were calling for change, and change would be enforced after the Second Vatican Council concluded in 1965. But at the time Armstrong was undergoing her noviceship, novices, quote, this I do want to stress, were told that if we were not finding it unbearably hard, then that was a pretty good indication that we weren't trying hard enough. Armstrong states that in the novitiate, the most difficult thing is to come to terms with yourself. I had never fully realized how much the world outside the convent shields an individual from having to endure any great degree of unpleasant self-knowledge. We are expected to be social animals and seek company. Most of us have to work with other people. There is marriage, where one's partner can try to build up an ego that is in danger of crumbling. In the 20th century, there are any number of easy ways to escape from yourself: television, cinema, endless noise on the radio, rush, bustle, socializing. In the convent, there are just acres of time with yourself and God. I had never had a particularly high opinion of myself. I knew that I had faults, but they didn't seem much worse than anyone else's. I had a reasonable number of talents, nothing very spectacular, to counterbalance the things I couldn't do. Nothing in my past life had prepared me for this intensely intimate knowledge of myself. However hard I tried to keep the rule, however hard I tried to pray, to practice humility, charity, and the rest of it, however hard I tried to change myself, I failed. Intimate, petty little failures. A dramatic public failure occurs when Armstrong faints one morning during meditation. Overwhelmed by flashing lights and a sulfurous odor, she falls to the floor, unconscious, only to be roused a few minutes later by a very irate nun, Mother Walter, the novice mistress. "How dare you, sister? How could you make an exhibition of yourself like that?" Mother Walter scolds. "If you feel faint, it is quite simple. You sit down and put your head between your knees. Then, if you find that you are no better, you leave the church as unobtrusively as possible and get some fresh air. You do not disturb your sister's prayer by falling about on the ground in that disgusting display of hysteria." Still on the floor, Armstrong apologizes for her weakness, saying, "Something seemed to take me over." "Precisely," Mother Walter replies, "and I'll tell you what did take you over. Your feelings, raw and undisciplined emotion." When Armstrong begins to cry, Mother Walter takes this as vindication of her assessment. "Look at you, weeping when your superior corrects you. You are here to learn from your faults, sister, and how can you possibly learn them unless I tell you? And here you are, giving way to self-pity on top of everything else." Mother Walter orders Armstrong to bed. Armstrong is soon joined in her dormitory by an older nun who, in defiance of the rules, gives Armstrong a hug. "You feel too much, sister," the older nun says gently. "You mustn't. Feelings don't count, you know. Feelings don't count." Taking solace in the kind embrace of another human being, Armstrong, a mere teenager, softens enough to ask a central pivotal question. "How can I stop wanting people to love me?" Which, after all, is something she is expected to do, since only God's love can provide fulfillment. The answer she is given is that she simply must do it, though she needs to try to be more peaceful about the process, avoiding in particular indulgences like fainting. The possibility that there might be some physical disorder causing the faints is never considered while she's in the order. Even the psychiatrist Armstrong sees immediately after leaving the order assume that the nuns were right and that the agonizing faints, as well as terrifying hallucinations that make her fear for her sanity, are the result of emotional stress and mental strain. They never once suggest investigating a physical cause. It's not until Armstrong suffers a grand mal seizure in the Baker Street tube station 10 years after the initial bout of fainting that all her symptoms are explained by the simple diagnosis of temporal lobe epilepsy, a condition eventually brought under control by appropriate medication. Although many people would have been devastated by such a diagnosis, Armstrong finds it a gift, since it means she no longer need fear she'll end up in a padded cell, she no longer need reproach or despise herself after she suffers a blackout, and she need not waste any more time trying to control the uncontrollable with a determined act of will. In the afterword to Through the Narrow Gate, Armstrong writes that one of the crucial mistakes in the entire experience, quote, was the overvaluing of the will. How lovely it would be if the will really were supreme, if the mass of muddly impulses and disorders and the murky subconscious would all be controlled by a strong act of will. In the order, I discovered that we are complex beings, mind, heart, soul, and body, engaged in a continuous bloody battle. Indeed, one of the most important things I learned from the religious life was the relative impotence of the will. It's a good, though humbling, thing to realize. Armstrong's experiences make clear the relative impotence of the will in relation not only to the body but the mind. In 1965, the order decides to have Armstrong study English literature with an eye to her teaching the subject at a convent school. Simultaneously studying for a theology diploma from the church while pursuing a bachelor's degree at Oxford, Armstrong notices that her mind, quote, was beginning to work two quite different ways. With literature, she'd start on a train of thought and follow wherever it led, end quote. However, it's a different matter in her theological studies where she didn't have the same kind of freedom. When she'd start to write an essay, she knew what conclusion she had to come to in order to remain orthodox. Her job here was to juggle facts and make facts and material to produce the correct conclusion. Having trained her mind to think critically and carefully in certain areas, she cannot prevent it from exercising those skills in certain others. She is able to write orthodox papers and earn the diploma, but she is not able to avoid recognizing the ways in which such exercises are intellectually and morally inferior to genuine exploration, although that recognition precipitates pain and confusion. She sees the inadequacy of orthodoxy and obedience without being equal to the task of critiquing them in all the ways they deserve. Years later, she would write, "Blind obedience and unthinking acceptance of authority figures may make an institution work more smoothly, but the people who live under such a regime will remain in an infantile, dependent state. It is a great pity that religious institutions who often insist on this type of conformity, which is far from the spirit of their founders, who all, in one way or another, rebelled against the status quo." Eventually, the strain of trying to think two different ways becomes too much. No longer able to acquiesce quietly to the intellectual helplessness orthodoxy encourages, she suffers a breakdown and, after a few months, is forced to admit that the life of a nun is not for her.
While waiting for the dispensation that will release her from her vows, she listens one day to the choir sing the prayer of St. Ignatius, which reads, "Take and receive, O Lord, all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my will. All that I have, all that I am, thou hast given me, and I give it all back to thee to be governed according to thy will. All I ask is thy grace and thy love. With these I am rich enough, and I do not ask for anything else." Armstrong details her response to the prayer. She writes, "It was the last words that stung. I didn't get much sleep last night, so I'm just a little emotional to begin with, and then I find this material quite moving, so. All right, anyway. It was the last words that stung. I did want things other than God's love. I wanted human closeness, beauty, freedom of mind. I probably wouldn't get them, but I wanted them. God's love should have been enough. It was, in one sense, everything. But I did ask for other things, and if I stayed, I'd be grabbing at little unworthy human satisfactions." And she gives an example, as when sisters in the convent fell in love with a cat because they could not devote any affection to another human being. The prayer left an aching sadness, that perfect self-giving, that image of God as everything that still couldn't satisfy me. How could I be happy when I'd rejected everything? I'd undergone a training that had been planned by St. Ignatius and refined for 4 centuries by his successors. It was meant to last for life. Kneeling there that day, fighting with my tears, I knew it would. Always some part of me, perhaps the deepest part of me, who knew, would love this ideal and mourn its loss. In one sense, vows or no vows, I should be a nun all my life. A few weeks later, at the end of January 1969, she is dispensed from her vows and released into the world as a skinny, lonely 24-year-old woman with ugly, eccentric clothes. Installed in a dorm room at Oxford where she will continue her studies, she confides to two of her classmates, both young Catholic women, that she has left the order. After a few brief questions about why she decided to leave, the young women seize her hand and promise to look after her. Over the course of only a few hours, they take her shopping for new clothes, cut and style her hair, then accompany her to the dining hall so she need not make an entrance or sit alone. The contrast between the calculated coldness of the convent and the spontaneous warmth shown by these young women cannot be starker. They discover a human being in distress, forego judgment, and quite naturally and immediately, if a little clumsily, reach out to her in a compassionate desire to mitigate her suffering. This is the scene that ends the book. Although Armstrong would eventually realize that she no longer believes the doctrines of Catholicism and cannot call herself a Christian, she does not leave the Catholic Church when she leaves her order. Rather, she simply admits that she has failed at the most important undertaking a human being could attempt. Most people Armstrong encounters in the secular world assume she is relieved to be through with the experience and looking forward to things like traveling, making money, falling in love, all the things that, most people presumed, I'd been yearning to do for the past 7 years. Instead, as she explains in The Spiral Staircase, a memoir about life since the convent, she had no sense of boundless opportunity. Rather, she felt quite simply sad and was constantly racked by a very great regret. However, she gets on with the task at hand, which is to complete a bachelor's degree in English literature. She does very well indeed at this enterprise and wins a place at Oxford as a doctoral student, writing her thesis on Tennyson. Unfortunately, for reasons that seem vicious and baroque, she does not pass her thesis defense. A furor erupts. The chairman of the board acknowledges that an injustice had been done to poor Miss Armstrong, but, unfortunately, the sanctity of the Oxford doctorate could only be impaired by allowing Miss Armstrong and her thesis to undergo re-examination. A mere 6 years after failing spectacularly in one of the most important endeavors of her life, she fails at something that runs a close second. I can only imagine. I can't imagine. I don't even want to imagine what it would be like to have your dissertation fail. It's just, anyway. Moreover, these failures seem to have closed to her areas of her life that previously seemed to offer all available richness. Having lost her faith in the 6 years since she left the order, she finds religion distasteful. Years would pass before she could hear the words Tennyson, doctorate, or thesis without pain. But life must go on, so she goes to work teaching English at a private girls' school. Because her epilepsy interferes with her attendance at work, she is given a generous settlement and let go after 6 years. Published in 2000, it was reissued with a new preface written in light of the events of September 11, 2001. Armstrong concludes that preface by writing, "The hideous September attacks show that when people begin to use religion to justify hatred and killing, and thus abandon the compassionate, they have embarked on a course that represents the defeat of faith." Excuse me, a defeat for faith. This aggressive piety can tip some of its more extreme proponents into a moral darkness that endangers us all. If fundamentalists in all three faiths are beginning to embrace more radical and nihilistic creeds, this is a truly perilous development. It is all the more important, therefore, that we learn to understand what lies behind this profound desperation and what impels fundamentalists to act as they do. It is still the case that only a tiny proportion of fundamentalists take part in acts of terror, and that most are simply trying to lead a religious life in a world that seems, to them, inimical to faith. It would be tragic if our continued ignorance and disdain propelled more fundamentalists to violence. Let us do everything we can to prevent this fearful possibility. Can you hand me my water?
Absolutely.
Thank you. But rather than pursue an analysis of the battle for God, I want to return to the developments that enable Armstrong to write it and to the events that rekindle her interest in religion and the divine, awakening her to the truth that human beings are spiritual animals and have been since their earliest days. Men and women started to worship gods as soon as they became recognizably human, not simply because they wanted to propitiate powerful forces, she writes, but in order to, quote, "express the wonder and mystery that seemed always to have been an essential component of the human experience of this beautiful yet terrifying world. Like any other human activity, religion can be abused, but it seems to have been something that we have always done. It was not tacked on to a primordially secular nature by manipulative kings and priests, but was natural to humanity." In 1981, Armstrong published Through the Narrow Gate. It didn't earn much money, but it did gain her some attention, enough that she was invited to comment on religious topics for television. Eventually, she lands a job writing the text for a 6-part television documentary on St. Paul, and it is while doing research for this project that she realizes how profoundly ignorant she is about the origins of Christianity. She comes to the conclusion that it was not Jesus Christ or any of his immediate disciples who were the inventors of Christianity, but St. Paul, hence the title of the series, The First Christian. She also realizes that she has never thought carefully about Christianity's two sister religions, as she calls them, Judaism and Islam. She studies the three monotheistic religions' relationships to each other when asked to write a television series on the Crusades. Calling the story of the Crusades, quote, "a hideous chronicle of human suffering, fanaticism, and cruelty," end quote, she notes that studying them has a primary salutary, albeit painful, effect. It broke her heart. This broken heart is, of course, a necessary spiritual development. As she notes, "all the world's faiths put suffering at the top of their agenda because it is an inescapable fact of human life, and unless you see things as they really are, you cannot live correctly. But even more important, if we deny our own pain, it is all too easy to dismiss the suffering of others. Every single one of the major traditions, Confucianism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, as well as the monotheisms, teaches a spirituality of empathy by means of which you relate your own suffering to that of others. Learning how to cultivate and practice empathy is part of what makes it possible for her to write remarkably sympathetic biographies of Muhammad and the Buddha, activities in which she had to make a constant imaginative attempt to enter empathetically into the experience of another. Admittedly, this is a difficult thing to do. It takes self-awareness, generosity, and discipline to cultivate empathy, and even more hard work to act on it rather than resorting to anger and retaliation when someone attacks us or something we love. It is also necessary if we want to make any progress as spiritual human beings, and much of religion has been designed to help us do that hard work. If religion fails in this primary task, it fails supremely and definitively. One of the final insights offered in The Spiral Staircase is the absolute necessity of empathy as a criterion in judging the value of religion. Armstrong states, "The religious traditions were in unanimous agreement. The one and only test of a valid religious idea, doctrinal statement, spiritual experience, or devotional practice was that it must lead directly to practical compassion. If your understanding of the divine made you kinder, more empathetic, and impelled you to express this sympathy in concrete acts of loving kindness, this was good theology. But if your notion of God made you unkind, belligerent, cruel, or self-righteous, or if it led you to kill in God's name, it was bad theology. Armstrong notes as well that compassion is not always a popular virtue. In my lectures, I have sometimes seen members of the audience glaring at me mutinously. Where is the fun of religion if you can't disapprove of other people? There are some people, I suspect, who would be outraged if, when they finally arrive in heaven, they found everybody else there as well. But she stresses that, especially since 9/11, quote, our task now is to mend our broken world. If religion cannot do that, it is worthless. And what our world needs now is not belief, not certainty, but compassionate action and practically expressed respect for the sacred value of all human beings, even our enemies. Armstrong's autobiography ceases to have much of an external plot after she begins writing books on religion that most of her friends, colleagues, and associates insist will interest few but her. It takes a good long while for her agent to find a publisher for A History of God, but much to everyone's astonishment, the book is a major success. That success transforms her life. Even here, Armstrong sees a spiritual truth in operation. The great myths show that when you follow somebody else's path, you go astray. The hero has to set off by himself, leaving the old world and the old ways behind. He must venture into the darkness of the unknown, where there is no map and no clear route. He must fight his own monsters, not somebody else's, explore his own labyrinth, and endure his own ordeal before he can find what is missing in his life. Thus transfigured, he or she can bring something of value back to the world that has been left behind. But if the hero finds himself riding along an already established track, he is simply following in somebody else's footsteps and will not have an adventure. The wasteland in the Grail legend is a place where people live inauthentic lives, blindly following the norms of their society and doing only what other people expect. When I entered my convent, I thought I had embarked on a mystical adventure like that of Percival and the other knights of the Grail, but instead of finding my own path, I had to follow somebody else's. Instead of striking out on my own, I had conformed to a way of life and modes of thought that had often seemed alien. As a result, I found myself in a wasteland, an inauthentic existence in which I struggled mightily but fruitlessly to do what I was told. Her authentic life is the life of the mind, and it is here that she finds those few moments of transcendence mentioned in the title of this presentation. Occasionally, while sitting at my desk or poring over a dusty tome in the British Library, I would experience many seconds of transcendence, awe, and wonder that gave me some sense of what had been going on in the mind of the theologian or mystic I was studying. At such times, I would feel deeply stirred within myself and taken beyond myself in much the same way I was in a concert hall or theater. I was finding in study the ecstasy that I had hoped to find in those long hours of prayer as a young nun. When I shared this with my students at the rabbinical college where I taught, my boss in the comparative religion department told me with amusement that this was very Jewish. It was what Jews experienced when they studied Torah or Talmud. I also learned that St. Benedict had instructed his monks to spend part of the day in divine study, during which they would experience moments of oratio, or prayer. Religion starts with the perception that something is wrong, Armstrong observes, and one of the things that is wrong is that religion starts with the perception that something is wrong, end quote, Armstrong observes, and one of the things that is wrong is that the meaning of events is often not obviously manifest. Rather, meaning has to be made, which is not always an easy task. There are experiences in life that logic cannot account for, and the unseen often seems more real than the tangible and concrete. We must find ways to adequately account for our lived reality, even if that means resorting to imaginative, symbolic ideas of how the world functions and what events and objects signify. Above all, these ideas must work. When they cease to work, they are eventually discarded. Armstrong points out that Abraham and Jacob put their faith in the God they called El because he worked for them. They did not sit down and prove that he existed. People would continue to adopt a particular concept of the divine because it worked for them, not because it was scientifically or philosophically sound. End quote. Although Armstrong sees herself as sympathetic to and in many ways celebratory of religion and God, many devout Christians would be outraged by her concept of the divine. Armstrong sees belief in an anthropomorphic God, a glorified human being made divine, however much that belief continues to work for people, as both idolatry and a mark of immature spirituality. Discussing a personal God who does everything that a human being does, he loves, judges, punishes, sees, hears, creates, and destroys as we do, Armstrong acknowledges that such a deity reflects an important religious insight that no supreme value can be less than human. However, she continues, a personal God can become a grave liability. He can be a mere idol carved in our own image, a projection of our limited needs, fears, and desires. We can assume that he loves what we love and hates what we hate, endorsing our prejudices instead of compelling us to transcend them. When he seems to fail to prevent a catastrophe, or seems even to desire a tragedy, he can seem callous and cruel. A facile belief that a disaster is the will of God can make us accept things that are fundamentally unacceptable. The very fact that, as a person, God has a gender is also limiting. It means that the sexuality of half of the human race is sacralized at the expense of the female and can lead to a neurotic and inadequate imbalance in human sexual mores. A personal God can be dangerous, therefore. Instead of pulling us beyond our limitations, he can encourage us to remain complacently within them. He can make us as cruel, callous, self-satisfied, and partial as he seems to be. Instead of inspiring the compassion that should characterize all advanced religion, he can encourage us to condemn, judge, and marginalize. It seems, therefore, that the idea of a personal God can only be a stage in our religious development. And that is from A History of God, where she devotes 400 pages to detailing, contextualizing, and explicating writings by Jewish, Christian, and Muslim theologians, mystics, philosophers, and scholars regarding the nature of God, the numinous unseen mystery that, however elusive, remains a genuine felt presence throughout the world. Armstrong begins her history by considering briefly what these diverse monotheists might have told her as a teenager beginning her spiritual quest. Quote, "It would have saved me a great deal of anxiety to hear from eminent monotheists in all three faiths that instead of waiting for God to descend from on high, I should deliberately create a sense of him for myself. Other rabbis, priests, and Sufis would have taken me to task for assuming that God was, in any sense, a reality out there. They would have warned me not to expect to experience him as an objective fact that could be discovered by the ordinary process of rational thought. They would have told me that, in an important sense, God was a product of the creative imagination, like the poetry and music that I found so inspiring. A few highly respected monotheists would have told me quietly and firmly that God did not exist, and yet that he was the most important reality in the world." End quote. That is from the preface to A History of God. Page XX. So, Armstrong calls attention to the fact that statements like this last one are often paradoxical by intent, a way to prevent us from considering God merely another object in the universe, like a molecule, a tree, a planet, or a black hole, albeit more distant and complex and somehow responsible for the other objects. She also considers the death of God, proclaimed by Nietzsche in 1882, devoting her final chapter to the question, "Does God have a future?" She contemplates the, quote, "God-shaped hole," unquote, left in the universe by the disappearance of God, the result, she stresses, of making him into an existent being who could be killed, and what that God-shaped hole means both to atheists who are happy to live without him and former believers who mourn his present absence. I am wrapping up, so, okay. The religious approach Armstrong learns to value over certain belief in a personalized God is an open-minded curiosity about the mystery that exceeds our human understanding and pervades our world, which can be encountered through a patient, thoughtful silence. Armstrong stresses repeatedly throughout her work that sacred texts cannot be perused like a holy encyclopedia for clear information about the divine. It's just so weird to get your picture taken. So, anyway. Rather, we should treat scripture as a kind of poetry, quote, And this is one of my favorite things she ever wrote. It's just words to warm an English teacher's heart. The lead-in again. Rather, we should treat Scripture as a kind of poetry, quote, which read quickly or encountered in a hubbub of noise makes no sense. You have to open yourself to a poem with a quiet, receptive mind in the same way as you might listen to a difficult piece of music. You have to give it your full attention, wait patiently upon it, and make an empty space for it in your mind. And finally, the work declares itself to you, steals deeply into the interstices of your being, line by line, note by note, phrase by phrase, until it becomes part of you forever. Like the words of a poem, a religious idea, myth, or doctrine points beyond itself to truths that are elusive, that resist words and conceptualization. If you seize upon a poem and try to extort its meaning before you are ready, it remains opaque. If you bring your own personal agenda to bear upon it, the poem will close upon itself like a clam because you have denied its unique and separate identity, its own inviolable holiness. And that's from The Spiral Staircase, which I should mention, the metaphor of the spiral staircase comes from, I think it's Ash Wednesday by T.S. Eliot. So there's a reason why she refers to poetry throughout the book in this way. In other words, Scripture and myth are attempts to make the unseen visible, to express the ineffable, and to understand the unknowable. Therefore, if we consult statements about that which exists beyond the world of facts, which must be taken on faith and is beyond normal comprehension, and read them as if they are provable, logical statements of fact, we will be misled. Instead, when thinking about God, we should open ourselves to things that stimulate our imaginative and creative faculties. Armstrong observes, quote, many people in the West would be dismayed if a leading theologian suggested that God was in some profound sense a product of the imagination. Yet it should be obvious that the imagination is the chief religious faculty. It has been defined by Jean-Paul Sartre as the ability to think of what is not. Human beings are the only animals who have the capacity to envision something that is not present or something that does not yet exist but which is merely possible. The imagination has thus been the cause of our major achievements in science and technology, as well as in art and religion. The only way we can conceive of God, who remains imperceptible to the senses and to logical proof, is by means of symbols, which it is the chief function of the imaginative mind to interpret. An irony remarked upon by many scholars of religion is that while mystics from all traditions repeatedly stress that language is unequal to the task of describing either God's ineffable reality or an authentic encounter with the divine, they often wrote and wrote and wrote at length about their experiences and insight. In the same vein, I readily admit that a 35-minute presentation, even one containing some very long quotations, one of my friends gets very upset, quote is a verb, quotations is a noun, very long quotations, is unequal to the task of adequately summarizing or critiquing several thousand pages of autobiography, commentary, and scholarship. I do not pretend to offer a comprehensive account of all of Armstrong's ideas, but I hope I have at least managed to summarize adequately a few of her significant insights. Above all, I hope I have conveyed the sense I gained from her work that whatever the defeats, defects, and disappointments of our early religious training, a search for the numinous, the transcendent, the divine, and a quest for a religiously inspired ethos of compassion and love remain supremely worthy goals. Thank you.
Our first respondent is Parker Blount, after which we'll have some time for questions and answers.
Holly's done an excellent job, I think, of identifying the pivotal points in Karen Armstrong's spiritual life and putting them, even though in a rather lengthy paper, they're concise. And I think that for any of us at Sunstone, this paper should be of interest because I think we can find ourselves there. I am going to present my response as a letter. Dear Karen and Holly, several years ago I had a colleague whose office was just across the hall from mine. He and I both belonged to the only true church. Consequently, we were drawn together, and several times a week we ate our brown bag lunch together in one or the other's office. We shared similar views on so many things, particular basic values and hope for an eternal reward. The major difference between us was that we didn't both belong to the same only true church. He was Catholic and I Mormon. I am taken with the similarities that exist between the two of you, beginning with, like my friend and I, you both belong to the true way to salvation. Growing out of that devotion to the truth, your paths are remarkably similar. You both chose to devote yourself wholly and completely to serving the Lord. Both had a heavy dose of religious training, one through attending parochial school and the other through seminary and institute programs of the church. Both reached a point where you wanted to devote yourself to full-time service of the Lord. Karen entered the convent and Holly entered the mission field. Both committed to chastity and obedience. But in that dedicated service to church and God, something undefined and unseen turned in an unexpected direction. Faith and expectations were yanked like a rug underfoot, leaving you grasping for a non-existing handhold. The old explanations no longer sustained you. You each turned to academics with an increased intensity, both seeking higher degrees. From that platform, you found the means to address the disappointing vacuum left by certitude gone stale. You had the courage to step into your own life, and with that step, you knowingly put yourself at a sharp angle against all that you had known, been promised, and expected. I admire that courage to listen to your own voice, no matter how halting and wavering it may at times have been, and still may be. Heroes surrender to their own inner voice. I am reminded of the poem written by a friend of mine, a lovely young woman, poet, musician, and graduate of Emory University's Master of Divinity program, who too has looked hard at her own religious path. Emily Hancock, untitled. In the mid-morning heat, a crow overflew the sanded path. Its shadow missling toward me, a blade over the burnt grass, its flat black form rowing through blinding blue with the rustle of taffeta and a small tawny shape in its beak. I walked on and came upon a field of blackberry bushes, tiny swollen pearls of black and red lustering in the sun. The darkest sprang hot and sharp in my mouth, its wildness first sweet, then bitter on my tongue. That which appears to be sweet may turn out to be tart. It takes courage to admit, even to yourself, that what once was sweet has become now bitter, particularly when others around you are exclaiming how delicious and desirable to the taste it is. How can I not love you for your courage, your authenticity, and your vulnerability? How can I not love you for your willingness to share your pain at your loss and your joy at your gain? And I love you because you show me how to be me. Sincerely, Parker. Now, since I have the stand, I'm going to ask the first question for Holly. In what way has studying the writings of Karen Armstrong shaped your view of yourself in relationship to your own religious experience? What do you draw from your study of Karen Armstrong?
That's why I love him. He's just fabulous, isn't he? Thank you so much. I will try to keep this brief so other people have time to talk. But a dear friend of mine gave me a copy of A History of the World as a Christmas gift in 2001, and I read it with astonishment and relief and gratitude. Questions I had tried to articulate and managed to some extent, and other things that were just these inchoate doubts, I found expressed very coherently and clearly there. I thought, this is a very learned, intelligent person, and how validating it is for me to know that some of these suspicions I had can be confirmed. Then this same friend, he lives in Brussels. I went to visit him there. He gave me a copy of Through the Narrow Gate. He's also a... He was excommunicated for being gay, but he's one of my closest friends and is an RM, and he gave me this book. And I was on vacation in Belgium. I didn't read it, so I got on the plane to fly from Brussels to Phoenix, and it's a long flight, and I started reading the book, and I finished it, and I set it down, and I sat there trembling, and I picked it up, and I read the whole thing again, and then I set it down, and then I picked it up and reread the my favorite bits. We were both anorexic. We both had bizarre falls. I'm not apoplectic, but we both quote the same Hopkins poems. I am gall, I am heartburn. God's most bitter decree, bitter would have me be. One of his terrible sonnets. But the main thing is we were both consistently told as young women not to trust our own minds. My patriarchal blessing explicitly forbade me ever to criticize anyone in authority over me. That was the only thing I was warned against. Everything else would take care of itself as long as I never questioned anyone, from my husband to the prophet of the church. And, you know, what a terrifying specter, a 14-year-old girl who occasionally thinks for herself. Not long after that, I lost 6 pints of blood through intestinal hemorrhaging, and the doctors, after a long surgery, the doctors told me it was due to stress and that I worried too much. So not only could my mind damn me, it could kill me. And this is something she also was repeatedly told. And the ways in which she eventually succeeds to love her own mind is so astonishing and inspiring to me. And a mind that works really hard and asks as many questions as it can and sees what's wrong with things. A repetitive word in her work is critical, and we're told not to be critical, but she is, and that's one of the things I so admire about her and value and lessons I take from her. So anyway, anyone else who wants to come up and ask a question, please do.
I want to thank you, Holly, for that. I also love the writings of Karen Armstrong. They've helped me. In fact, I even have a letter I wrote that I never sent. But one of the questions, does she ever find a community of believers, of like-minded people? Is that important to her as she kind of leaves the Catholic faith? I think for a lot of us who are uncomfortable in an organized religious setting and have some of the same feelings you've mentioned, we still enjoy a community of saints, if you will, a community of believers where we can share our feelings in that. And has she found that, or is she truly an individual that doesn't work for her?
This is what's discussed in The Spiral Staircase. She teaches at the Leo Beck College of Rabbinical Studies in London and says she finds some community there. She also had she's one of the foremost experts on Islam in the world, and that grew out of spending time in Jerusalem. And this was in the early 80s, and just the incredible generosity and kindness of the Muslim community. And she has a lot of Muslim friends, and it's one reason she's so concerned about the events of 9/11. But she calls herself a freelance monotheist, and her sister, her sister was on some trashy British soap in the 70s, Coronation Street, I think it was, and then moved to California and became a Buddhist. And is fairly devout, from what I understand. So they kind of switched places. The one who is going to be famous now is living a quiet life somewhere in Northern California, and the one who is going to live a quiet life in England is now famous and travels the world. But she does talk about how remarkably lonely she is, and how, you know, since she travels so much, she can't even have a pet, and she's single, and which she says has both its benefits and its drawbacks. So she also says that she feels, I may paraphrase this slightly incorrectly, but she says that she feels incredibly loved and accepted in the United States, that we in the U.S. have, that her work is far more popular and accepted here, and she loves coming here for that reason, because she feels so loved and appreciated.
have a question. Does she speculate on the future of monotheism?
Yes. And it's in the chapter, Does God Have a Future? And I don't remember. I reread the book before. Yes, she does. I mean...
do you have a sense of her position?
Well, like she says, if religion can't help us heal our world, it's useless. And so it's the God always has to be a force that makes us better. And so God has a future in as long as he, she, it continues to do that. And she doesn't think that religion will go away. So, or that God will go away unless we send him away and don't let him back.
Are there any other questions? Okay, then we're at the end of our session. Thank you very much. Can we have a final hand for our speakers? Thank you.